Day of Atonement and Reflection. It's Yom Kippur for the Jews of the world. And this year, as the Arab Spring continues to transform the Middle East politically, Israel is seeing its role and security in the region shifting dramatically. But Israel's identity has come a long way from the folksy Zionist refuge that folk song suggests. An Israel that dreamed of being an agricultural utopia embracing secular democracy and peace in the lands of the Bible. Israel's difficult history has forced some much more military-sounding realism into the founders' dreams. Israel retains its national yearning for peace, but it very early on shed the folksy identity for a much more warlike one. The Israeli soldier and the IDF, the Israel Defense Force, bristling with the latest weapons, stands at the center of the Middle East today. And today Israel is much closer to a religion-dominated nation than it is to the folksy kibbutznik identity of old.
The Eretz Yisrael kam ha'am ha'yehudi ba utzva dmuto haruchnit.
David Ben-Gurion, Israel's first prime minister there, reading Israel's Declaration of Independence back in 1948, a declaration that was answered with a war with its neighbors, just the first of many. Has the culture of Israel become woven into a warlike ethos that the nation cannot escape politically? It's the premise of journalist and longtime Middle East reporter Patrick Tyler's latest book, Fortress Israel, the inside story of the military elite who run the country and why they can't make peace. Patrick Tyler, welcome to the program.
Thanks, John. I'm glad to be here.
So is there something inevitable about the influence of the military in Israel based on its history, or are these choices that were made internally inside Israel that have done what you say is a transformation of the country to an almost militaristic state?
I think it's both those currents, John. I mean, on the one hand, there was a crucial moment in the mid-1950s when David Ben-Gurion and the circle that coalesced around him had to make a decision about what kind of state, what kind of trajectory we're going to project over time. And he decided on a military society, one based more on Sparta than on Athens. And at the same time, once that institution was built, once that society was militarized, the country is the army to a great extent. You have the phenomenon of trade unionism that we have in our own military bureaucracy, that the military defends its interests. It is the most powerful, influential institution in Israel.
And how does that reflect itself in politics? And let's go back to, say, Menachem Begin, who was profoundly influenced by Ariel Sharon, Prime Minister Netanyahu, who gets an uncertain set of signals from the military leaders in the times that he's been the political leader of Israel.
That's very true. Netanyahu, as no one remembers better than himself in 1999, was basically run out of office by the cabal of the military establishment. Over 100 generals joined political parties to campaign against Bibi Netanyahu, and he lost that election. He's very aware of the support of the military establishment. Menachem Begin, Bibi Netanyahu, they have a common ancestor, however, and it goes back to Vladimir Jabotinsky, who's the father of the right wing in Israel, and who has this deep martial belief that the Arabs will never give up, that we're in a serial warfare against them, and that we're doomed to this kind of militaristic outlook.
Although it is the case in Israel that sense of doom from the Jabotinsky wing inside Israel, the military was very opposed to, that the military was a constraint, if anything, on that down through history, and not necessarily a militaristic advocate of that approach to the Arab world.
Israel is a moving debate. Its ideology of the leadership class is a moving target. However, I think you cannot look at the opened archives of the 1950s and not see a crucial debate between David Ben-Gurion and the man who succeeded him as prime minister, Moshe Sheret, who represented that engaging liberal wing, who spoke Arabic, who had lived in an Arab village, and who said that the only way that Israel gets security in the long term is by engaging the Arabs and integrating Israel into the Semitic Federation of the Middle East. Ben-Gurion thought that was a fool's argument, and he worked to undermine and destroy Sheret's career. He did. He succeeded at that.
How does that play on the ground among Israelis today? How does that debate play out today as they look around at the Arab Spring and see what looks sort of like democracies in places like Egypt and Tunisia and God knows what in Syria there on the northern border. And we'll get back to thinking about the leaders in a moment. What do Israelis say about this?
Yeah, my Israeli research assistant tells me that the Israelis try not to think about politics today. I think it's largely true. The country is delaminated. It's fractured. It's very hard to find a consensus on anything. But one thing is clear. The country runs on tension. There's a great deal of nervousness about the Arab Spring, but also a recognition that there are opportunities out there. But the country hasn't made up its mind about which direction it's going to go. Netanyahu is running a government that's basically focused tightly in the same way Ben-Gurion focused his government on peril and threat, because that is a politically unifying force.
Although it is also the case in Israel that its leaders come in with maybe a military, possibly right-wing approach, confrontational approach. I think of Rabin, I think of Menachem Begin, and I think of Ariel Sharon. All three leaders came in like a lion, but each one of them in the end realized that the only possible way forward was to make peace. If that is the case, it certainly argues the premise of your book, why they can't make peace. It seems like the leaders in Israel are actually trying.
They have tried. There have been great milestones of peace. Menachem Begin, you cannot take away the triumph of Camp David, but you have to look at it in the larger context of what was really Begin's focus, and that was to destroy the PLO after Camp David. And then so we segued into the war in Lebanon, which was the greatest disaster in their modern history. Rabin crossed the Rubicon. He was the military man who engaged the Arabs, and so he was definitely of the prototype of it you speak. And he learned how to make peace, but he paid for it with his life. Rabin failed. He was killed, and the military establishment thereafter overthrew the strategic focus on peace and went back to security. And that's when Sharon came in and said, I will deliver security. And I don't know what transformation you're talking about with Sharon. He was a very, very tough leader. He made the Israelis feel very, very secure because he used the club. But he didn't go for the grand bargain with the Arabs. He wasn't interested in it.
He was on the way to somewhere, but we'll never know because of his health failing. What do you make of the anger that has, your book has certainly generated from some Israelis? Hillel Halkan, reviewing in the Wall Street Journal, said, Israel always has been, and today more than ever, is a fractious democratic society in which it is the politicians and the judges who have the final say. He called the premise of your book bogus.
Yeah. You write a book, you send it out there. Mo Udall used to say that you say a prayer that may I speak gently, for tomorrow I may have to eat my words. But I think Halkan is basically an ideologue, and he tried to argue that my book is an ideological tract. It's not. I'm a journalist. I have no ideological profile.
Finally, before we go, has Israel lost something if the premise that you write about is true?
I think it's lost that great Rabin spirit of engaging the enemy, of looking out at the Arab world and seeing opportunity. Begin didn't see that. Rabin did. Moshe Sheret did. And I think the Netanyahu government has lost that spirit.
Patrick Tyler's latest book is Fortress Israel, the inside story of the military elite who runs the country and why they can't make peace. If you'd like to weigh in on this or any conversation on the program, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post a comment at thetakeaway.org.